We can not join yet. This is great. Oh, actually, I think, yeah, and I think Edgar was in the meeting. Hello, everyone. We're going to give it just another half a minute to make sure our numbers are stabilized. People are joining.
Irina, I can't see the Q&A, so you can just handle that on your end. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us here in person. It's great to see people in the room despite last-minute changes in the rooms. And thank you, everyone, for joining us online. And we apologize for a couple-minute delay. We had some technical difficulties. You would think by now we know how to do Zoom, but things come up. So thank you very much for your patience. Today, we are very, very excited to have the distinguished lecturer, Rebecca Willett, Dr. Rebecca Willett, joining us. You can look at her bio. She has quite an extensive, a very impressive bio. I'm just going to highlight a few things, but we're really excited to have you today talk to us about the machine learning foundations and looking really at the importance of that, how to help us accelerate innovation, and also just making sure we promote trustworthiness and do we really know what AI is doing. So I'm really excited about the talk. So let me highlight just a couple of things before I hand it off. I'm sure you'll do a better job of highlighting some of the things as well. So she's currently a professor in statistics and computer science in the director of the AI in the Data Science Institute, University of Chicago, and holds a courtesy appointment in the Toyota Institute, Technology Institute in Chicago as well. Some of the accomplishments I wanted to highlight, she's a fellow of IEEE. She's also a fellow of SIAM, and her research have been really recognized with very distinguished awards, such as Career Award from NSF, which of course is the best,
of course,
but also DARPA and Young Fellow from OFOSAR. So I think without taking more time on the introduction, I just wanted to hand it over to you. I do want to also highlight, we're excited to see that not just only all the phenomenal accomplishments that you've done in the research, but also a great advocate for this broadening participation and diversity in STEM, and very, you know, exciting, a lot of the programs of involving women all the way from middle school to looking at the undergraduate, graduate level, and the faculty. So really phenomenal accomplishments on the research side, and of course, on a lot of the broader impacts of that as well. So with that, I'm just going to hand it off to you, and
great,
you take it away.
Thank you so much, Irina, for that. Thank you. And thank you for that kind introduction. It's really a huge honor and great pleasure to be here and part of your distinguished lecture series. So my time or history with the NSF actually is quite long. I was a NSF graduate research fellow as a graduate student. And in fact, when I was a graduate student, I was studying medical imaging and other kinds of signal processing. And one day when I was doing my research, I went across the street to the medical center to talk with a collaborator. And in the elevator, there was an advertisement about an fMRI study. And it said anybody who would participate in this fMRI study would get a free CD with all of their brain data. So naturally, I signed up immediately because I really wanted this CD of all my brain data. And it was really fun. They were trying to understand how our brain reacts to different pleasurable stimuli. So I got orange Kool-Aid and water, and they wanted to know if random orange Kool-Aid was more exciting than regular orange Kool-Aid. And it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. But then a couple of weeks later, the PI for this experiment gave me a call, and he said, well, we were analyzing all the data for the experiment, and we actually noticed that there was a tumor in your brain. And so he said, you know, we're just using a research scanner, but you really need to go get a clinical scan and talk to a neurosurgeon. And so I did, and, you know, they were able to remove it. It was totally benign. There were no lasting repercussions or anything. But I was thinking about this story because I think that every aspect of this story is really going to be fundamentally changed by AI and machine learning. It's going to affect the way psychologists design these types of experiments. It'll change the way that we acquire the medical imaging data the way that we take that data and form an image for somebody to interpret, or the way that computers are used to help interpret those images. It's going to affect the way surgeons plan and execute surgeries, and even affect the pharmaceuticals that are prescribed post-operations. And I think the impacts of AI and machine learning go beyond healthcare. So we've heard people talking about the potential of machine learning to help. Sorry, I'm just getting a notification here from Zoom. Sorry about that. We've heard people talking about the potential of AI and machine learning to impact all kinds of things that the National Science Foundation cares about. Developing a new understanding of the rules of life or the laws of nature, accelerating affordable drug development, especially for, you know, somewhat rare diseases or underserved communities, engineering green materials, building quantum computers, and even developing sustainable climate policies. And when you hear these lists, I think it's tempting to think that we've just developed great machine learning and AI technologies. We see evidence of that regularly. And that all that's left to do, perhaps, is to take those tools and figure out how to plug them in to different domains. But what I'd really like to emphasize today is that that is not the state of the world, that it's absolutely vital that we invest in fundamental AI and machine learning research. And in particular, I would like to claim that if we try to develop applied machine learning without really understanding the mathematical, statistical, and computational foundations, it's sort of akin to developing biotech without understanding the underlying biology. So maybe we'll get lucky and hit on a couple of successes. But if we really want to accelerate innovation, and if we really want to develop tools that are trustworthy, that scientists can trust, for instance, then we need to develop these foundations. So with that in mind, today I want to have cover two core areas. One is just trying to do a retrospective look at some of the areas where the machine learning foundations that have been developed by the community and supported by the NSF have really had a major impact on the field and on practice. And then second, I want to talk about some of the emerging and future directions within the AI and machine learning communities and the role that foundational research is expected to play in those areas and what some of the major open questions are. Okay, so first let's just talk about some examples where foundational research has really been impactful and where we needed that understanding. And I think maybe the first example that would come to mind for many of us is in the context of optimization theory. So when we're performing machine learning, we set up a model, and that model has got parameters, or in the context of a neural network, we've got weights on all of the different nodes. And what we do is we take training data and figure out how to set those parameters or weights so that we make good predictions on the training data. And we do this by solving an optimization problem. So we're going to compute gradients of some loss function at our current values of the parameters and update them based on gradients, on the gradients of the loss. The one foundational innovation that's relatively recent that I'd like to highlight is, for instance, Adagrad. And what Adagrad does is it takes these gradients of the losses and adapts them to past parameter estimates or past weight estimates. And this ultimately, it can accelerate training. It means that we can find good parameter estimates with many fewer iterations. And this kind of theoretical foundational algorithm is one of the key ideas that underpins, for instance, the ADAM algorithm, which is widely used across industry, academia, national labs, et cetera, for training machine learning models. Another example tied to optimization is distributed optimization across a collection of computers, say nodes in a cluster. So the expectation is that if I were to invest money and double the size of my cluster, then I should be able to train my machine learning method twice as fast. But in early days of machine learning practice, this expectation was not realized. We very quickly hit a point of diminishing returns where I maybe would double my investment in computational infrastructure and only get a tiny little improvement in the speed of my training. And so foundational, fundamental research in optimization and distributed optimization helped us understand why this was occurring. And that in turn led to new algorithms. And just one example of this is the Hogwild algorithm that was developed at the University of Wisconsin, where I used to work, where they used some of these theoretical insights to develop asynchronous distributed optimization methods that had this expected property, right? If I were to double the size of my computational infrastructure, then I would come close to doubling the speed of my training. And this led to many other innovations in terms of distributed optimization that were fundamental to training some of the large scale tools that we see prevalent today, like ChatGPT. I'd also like to highlight privacy guarantees. So when we're dealing with machine learning data and it reflects human data, we want to make sure that their privacy is protected. One standard that people use to say whether their algorithm is protecting people's privacy is something called K-anonymity. So K-anonymity says that I'm going to transform my data just enough to make sure that any individual in my data set is going to be indistinguishable from K other individuals. And this standard is encoded into law, right? This is considered sufficient for fulfilling laws like HIPAA requirements in the US or GDPR in the European Union. But recently, one of my colleagues at UChicago, Aloni Cohen, showed that this is actually a vulnerable standard. He said, you know, when people actually apply this, they don't want to change their data too much because they want to learn from it as much as possible. And so they would redact the minimum possible amount of information to satisfy this requirement. And so that gives a malicious actor some additional information about that data set. So initially, this work got a somewhat negative reaction. People said, well, this is sort of like a theoretical bound, but I don't know how you could use that in a practical sense to risk someone's privacy. But then Aloni and his collaborators actually came up with an algorithm based on these theoretical foundational insights that demonstrated how you could leverage this insight to violate people's privacy. And so I think this is a really key example of how foundational research is absolutely essential. And sort of analogously, we've had a lot of work done supported by the NSF in areas like differential privacy, which give us an alternative mechanism for trying to safeguard privacy by adding random perturbations to the data. And these are coming with, you know, statistical guarantees that were absent from the kind of K-anonymity standards that we were just considering. Another area where foundational research has really impacted machine learning is in quantifying uncertainty. So we often think about machine learning tools as taking in an input, say a feature vector, and producing a label, a prediction. But in many, many settings, we don't only want sort of a point prediction, we want some uncertainties associated with that prediction. And this is essential in all kinds of contexts, climate analysis, model predictive control, automatic translation, and in a variety of other settings. So people have thought about uncertainty quantification for a very long time. And classical methods might require a simple model, like we're just going to do linear regression, in which case neural networks would have no guarantees at all. Or they would have very strong prior knowledge, like we know exactly what the distribution underlying our data is, which in general we would never know. But recent efforts have focused on ideas like conformal prediction. And these tools are allowing machine learning people to assess the uncertainty of predictions with theoretical guarantees and really minimal assumptions. These can work with black box models, whatever new fancy neural network you come up with all the bells and whistles, you can still use the ideas from this toolbox. And this has had really broad impact. It's been used from contexts that range all the way from object pose estimation to biomolecular design to analyzing polls for political or for elections to even clinical medical sciences. Okay, so one final example where we've seen foundational research really have a big impact in the machine learning context is oh, sorry, not final, second to last, is in allocating data collection resources. So one of the giant bottlenecks that we experience is not necessarily with the training, but just the initial collection of the data or the curating and annotating of that data. So tools like banded algorithms, active learning, Bayesian optimization, all things that are foundational, fundamental research, can be used to guide data collection and labeling. And these are not just sort of theoretical algorithms that nobody uses in practice. People are actively using these kinds of ideas in industry, for instance, for ad placement. Okay, so now one final example. I want to return to this medical imaging context that we started off with. And I've got a video here that highlights how a CAT scanner works, a CT scanner. So basically you lie in the scanner and it shoots x-rays through your body. And on the other end, you measure what's called the absorption profile, how much of that x-ray energy was absorbed for each of the different x-ray rays. And what I'm going to show here on the right is that absorption profile. Each column is going to correspond to a different absorption profile. White will mean high absorption and dark will mean low absorption. So this whole apparatus rotates around your body, and we measure the absorption profile for each rotation, and it forms a different column in this set of observations. So this thing on the right is what we would actually collect with a scanner. It's called a cynogram. And the core next task is to map that cynogram to an image that a radiologist can actually look at. So this is a difficult process. This is an ill-posed inverse problem. It's really sensitive to noise and other kinds of challenges. And so what people started asking is, well, can I somehow leverage machine learning to improve this image reconstruction process? And so initial early estimates took collections of cynograms and images and some off-the-shelf neural network architecture and tried to train the network to actually perform this reconstruction. And if you just had enormous quantities of data, then this worked okay. It was a great proof of concept and spurred a lot of interest. But it also just ignores everything we know about the data collection process. Because in this kind of simple paradigm, we're forcing the network to learn two things. First, it has to learn something about the geometry and the structure of the images that we want to reconstruct, which is something that hopefully training data can give us insight into. But second, it's having to learn something about the relationship between that image and the cynogram, which is something that we absolutely know, right? Because we engineered our CT scanners. And so this is where, you know, foundational research really comes into bear. We say, well, can we design a neural network that reflects our knowledge of this underlying physics? And the answer is yes. And to figure out the best way to do it, we build upon foundational research in inverse problem theory, data assimilation, signal processing, optimization, and in other fields as well. So let me just give you a little bit of nuance for this one particular example. So our goal is to reconstruct an image that I'm going to call X from a cynogram that I'll call Y. And we think about Y as being some function H times X plus epsilon, where H is basically telling us what the physics of this forward model is. And in a classical setting, before we bring machine learning into the mix, the way we might approach this is to search over all possible images and find one that, first of all, is a good fit to the data. And when we're measuring how good of a fit it is to the data, we take this forward model, this model of how the CT scanner works, into account. But second, we recognize that this is really sensitive to noise and measurement error and other things. And so we also try to make sure that whatever image we come up with is a reasonable image. And classically, we would say, prefer to have images that are smooth, maybe sparse in some wavelet basis or something like that. Mathematicians would sit around and figure out a good value of this regularization function. And once we had this set up, we could use an optimization routine to find this good image. So we would generally alternate between two steps, where in the first step, we would take our current estimate and nudge it a little bit to be closer to our observed data. And this is where we take our physical model of the CT scanner into account. And then second, we would apply some regularization step where we would say, I'm going to take my intermediate estimate and just clean it up a little bit, make sure it's a little bit smoother, that I've reduced some of the errors in it. And we would alternate between this, and you can even represent this as a block diagram. So now we can say, all right, now I want to use machine learning. So I've talked about the naive machine learning approach. I've talked about the classical inverse problems approach. And a nice hybrid turns out to be to replacing this regularization step that before, you know, mathematicians and signal processors would dream up with a trained component, a neural network that we can actually set the weights of. And so with what's called the deep unrolling framework, we try to set the weights of this neural network so that the final output after some number of blocks is a faithful reconstruction of the image, and we use our training data to set that. So first of all, this works really nicely in practice. So in the context of MRI, for instance, it allows us to get really accurate reconstructions, even when we've got, say, a factor of 6 fewer measurements than we have pixels we want to reconstruct. So we're figuring out how to basically fill in the blanks very accurately using these machine learning tools. And not only that, but we can use the networks that we learn in order to facilitate even faster data acquisition. So I could maybe have the number of samples be a factor of 8 smaller than the number of pixels that I want to reconstruct. But what I think is even more interesting and exciting about this is a little bit more subtle perhaps. So we had this block diagram before, and we said we were going to train the neural networks within this block diagram. But all of these data consistency blocks, we can think about them also as neural networks, where the weights are fixed and determined by the physics of our system, determined by this forward model H. And so putting all the pieces together, we effectively have one giant neural network where some of the blocks are fixed and determined by the physics and the setup that we're dealing with. And some of the blocks are unknown and have weights that we can learn using training data. And so this is an example, I think, of where incorporating physical models, foundational inverse problem theory, and optimization methods has led to new ways of thinking about how to design neural network architectures that go way beyond just taking an off-the-shelf architecture and plugging it in like the early work did. Okay, so overall, all of the advances that I've just described are the result of just decades of NSF investment in foundational research. These are not things that people just stumbled upon by running millions of experiments. They stemmed from really deep understanding of the issues at play. But like I said, that's not the end of the story. I think there still remain some really major foundational questions that we need to be answering. It's not a matter of taking the existing tools and plugging them in different contexts. So one example, for instance, addresses a problem that I think we're all aware of with AI and machine learning tools having some really serious societal implications that are concerning, biases arising or these tools being used for malicious purposes. And we really should worry about that when these tools are being incorporated into healthcare, deciding who gets a mortgage or other kinds of financial tools. So because of this, a number of people have said, well, we really need to design regulations and certifications of ML algorithms. And I think this is really well-intentioned, but this is something where I think foundational research is absolutely essential. And to see why, just think back to this earlier example that we talked about with privacy, right? Where we developed laws without really understanding all of the technical underpinnings, without really understanding how these things might work or where they might fail. And we ended up with laws that really did not satisfy the spirit of what we were trying to accomplish, right? People's privacy wasn't actually preserved. And so if we want to come up with technical regulations and certification policies, we really need to understand how these methods work to ensure that these regulations will be efficacious. In addition, many of you are probably aware that when we train these super large scale systems, it's really not climate friendly. There's an enormous carbon footprint associated with training large scale models. And the data that we use to fuel these models is stored in big data warehouses. They have to be kept cool with water, even in states with major water shortages.
And I think there's a real desire to figure out how we can get all the power and benefits of these tools without destroying the climate. And I would argue that the mathematical, statistical, and computational foundations of machine learning, by understanding those, it's going to help us optimize architectures and training efficiency. So we're going to be able to figure out how to compress these models or train them with fewer steps or develop low power implementations that become much more efficient. And these kind to kind of see how we might use foundations to address this, I want to kind of highlight some kind of broader questions that are related to this. Things like, how much data do I really need to train my model for a given problem? Is it going to be robust, or what do I need to do to make sure it's going to be robust? After I train it, if I use it in a slightly different context, is it still going to work? How can I make these things sustainable? And do specific architectures, like say transformers that underlie ChatGPT, what's really like the essential ingredient inside that architecture? And can we use that insight to design the next generation of methods and models? So to get at these kinds of questions, some people in the community are thinking about neural networks as functions, right? The neural network takes in an input and produces an output that's a function of the input. And with that perspective, we can suddenly say, well, are there ideas from computational harmonic analysis or functional analysis or signal processing that can give us insight into how well we can estimate these functions or understand how they're going to perform in different settings? So to give you a flavor of that, for instance, what I'm showing here are two different functions. They're both functions in 2D, so they've got inputs x1 and x2, and the color is indicating the value of the function. And there's also some kind of hard to see little dots here. Those would be training samples. So both of these functions fit the training samples exactly. These are interpolating functions. So when we train a neural network, if we're able to train it to exactly fit our training data, which happens many, many times, it's the I would say the most common mode of operation, then we're essentially finding an interpolating function. But as this example illustrates, there's many possible interpolating functions. So which is the one that we're trying, which is the one that we ultimately find? And how do think, excuse me, how do things like our training algorithm or our choice of architecture or other features affect what function we ultimately fit to the data? And what implications that has for things like robustness. Okay, so a little bit more sort of application oriented. I started off talking about these moonshot problems in the sciences that the NSF, I think, cares about very deeply. And I think that machine learning is really gonna fundamentally change the way that we approach these problems. So one aspect of that is sort of obvious, right? We're going to take data from experiments, and then we're going to try to analyze that data using machine learning methods. But in addition to that, there are opportunities for machine learning to affect hypothesis generation, or to affect how we design experiments, or the way that we handle simulations. It's really going to affect every aspect of the scientific method. So people are exploring these ideas, but in many cases, it's sort of on a kind of case-by-case basis. Let me think about experimental design in biology. Let me think about simulations in physics. But I really believe that there are some deep foundational questions that we can think about that span all the different application domains, that making investments in those areas and building up those foundations will be deeply impactful in just thinking about machine learning and the scientific discovery process. So those four kind of prevailing themes, and I'm going to elaborate on all of them, are uncovering new laws of nature, AI-guided scientific measurement, physics-informed machine learning, and advancing machine learning frontiers. So uncovering new laws of nature. What I mean by this is we want to be able to take observations of some sort of physical system and then use AI or machine learning to uncover the governing physical laws. So just as an example, here I've got a video that's illustrating two particles moving according to these three equations. This is called the Lorenz 63 system, and it's a chaotic system. So you can see as time progresses, these particles can be pretty far apart. And it's a nice model for things like atmospheric convection and studying various processes. So in this particular case, the data was generated by a particular system of equations. But in many scientific settings, we just get observations. And what we would like to be able to do is to figure out a good descriptive series of equations. And that's going to help us understand how to extrapolate our observations to new settings and new contexts, hopefully. And so the question is, can we use machine learning or AI to do this mapping? And it sounds a little bit magical, but I'm going to give you a hint at how some of these methods might be achievable. But first of all, I just want to emphasize, if we can figure out foundational tools for solving this problem, it could be enormously impactful from trying to figure out biophysical forces of cell development to soft condensed matter and polymer physics so we can design better materials, to trying to understand the dynamics of microbial communities so we can figure out, for instance, how to better break down plastics, or even studying phenomena revealed by agent-based models, such as how people respond to different pandemic policies, for instance. Okay, so why is this not just pie in the sky thinking? So if we return to the Lorenz 63 example, remember there were three variables, X, Y, and Z, for the X, Y, 3D location of each particle. So if we just think about how the X location is evolving over time, we assume we don't know that equation, but we're going to write it down as a weighted sum of things like the X location, the Y location, the Z location, the X location squared, et cetera. And then we're going to use our observations to estimate what these weights are. And so using sparse estimation routines, what we would uncover is that all of these blue, green W's are zero and the red W's are non-zero. And then that gives us a nice simple expression for the temporal evolution of the X variable. And we can do the same for the Y's and the Z's and uncover those dynamics. So this kind of simple idea has been the catalyst of a lot of interesting work. People have demonstrated how they can recover orbital mechanisms using these kinds of tools. Tools like AI Feynman have tried to take these ideas and generalize them in pretty exciting ways. But ultimately, we want the equations to come out of this to be trustworthy, right? There's always room for error because the space of equations is enormous. But we'd at least like this to be a useful and rigorous and robust mechanism for hypothesis generation. And so in order to do that, we really need to, again, invest in foundational research into how we can use AI and machine learning tools to ensure that this is useful. Okay, so the second prong of how AI and machine learning are affecting science is in AI-guided scientific measurement. And what I mean here is to use AI or machine learning to design better experiments, simulations, and sensors. So just as an example, let's say that I want to design a microbial community for a specific purpose, say to break down plastics or as a therapeutic for somebody whose gut microbiome is out of whack or something like that. So what I know is that the efficacy of the community is going to be a function of all different kinds of things. It's going to depend on what strains are present in what densities, what nutrients are present, what antimicrobial peptides are present, and what the environmental conditions are. So we don't know this function. We just know that somehow it exists, and we want to figure out what's the best way to set all these different variables in order to maximize the fitness. The problem is that there's just so many possibilities that we can't possibly try them all. We only have finite experimental resources. And if we were to sample at random, then the risk is that we end up evaluating a lot of different communities that are nowhere near the maximum that we're looking for. And so this is where some of the ideas that I mentioned earlier related to active learning and BADNet methods or even uncertainty quantification are really essential to help us guide these sequences of measurements. And so investing in these foundational areas is kind of fueling this work. And we've seen that people are really trying to scale these ideas up. Different labs, both in academia and industry, are building self-driving laboratories for things like material design. And even in the pharmaceutical industry, when people talk about the design, make, test, and analyze cycle of designing new drugs, they are starting to incorporate these kinds of ideas. Okay, so the third prong here is physics-informed machine learning. And here what I mean is that we want to optimally leverage physical models along with experimental or observational data. So I already kind of hinted at this when we had our discussion about CT and MRI, but really there's just tons of settings where we have both physical knowledge as well as data. Large-scale physics experiments like photon sources or synchrotrons or LIGO experiments for measuring gravitational waves, things like molecular structure estimation or even climate forecasting. We have decades of foundational research in those areas that inform what's happening under the hood and can complement our data. And so the question really becomes, well, how do we leverage it? Now, one thing people have thought about is trying to use that physical knowledge to build large, complex simulations. And then you might say, okay, I want to use that simulation data in order to train a machine learning model. And then hopefully that's going to give me good predictions about what's going to happen in the real world. I think that hope is possible, but I also think that in order to make this succeed, we have to understand things about distribution drift, because the distribution of my simulated data is not the distribution of real life data. Transfer learning, data assimilation, reduced order modeling, and active learning. So in order to really fully leverage simulations within our machine learning ecosystem, we have to invest in these foundational areas. Moreover, I think broadly speaking, right, there's lots of areas where physical models can help inform machine learning. We've talked about leveraging simulations. There's work in areas like physics-informed neural networks where people are trying to accelerate the simulations using machine learning tools. And we'll talk a tiny bit about that later. Or even upscaling molecular dynamics simulations. And I would claim that figuring out the best way to incorporate physics information is absolutely essential to making sure that these methods are robust, that they're going to work when you have relatively little training data, and really critical in the sciences. We need this physical knowledge in order to help us extrapolate beyond the domain of the training data, right? This is what science is all about. And if we don't incorporate our physical models, then we risk really getting a new understanding that's in a very limited domain. Okay, so finally, I wanna talk about advancing machine learning frontiers, like really fundamental machine learning and AI research areas that are broadly applicable in the sciences. So one area that's received quite a bit of attention lately is learned emulators. So for example, I've got, say, a large-scale climate simulation that I can only run on a supercomputer and it takes a very long time. What I'd like to be able to do is to form a training data set using past simulations and use that to train a machine learning model, say a neural network, that's going to mimic that simulator, but at a tiny fraction of the computational cost. So that then, if I want to run a future simulation, instead of needing my supercomputer, maybe I can use my desktop. So this is the goal, and there have been some anecdotal successes that are really exciting, including one paper that was highlighting just orders of magnitudes of acceleration using machine learning tools. And I would characterize this line of research as being an example of a broader class of problems that I would call generative models for science. So generative models include things like ChatGPT for text or DALL-E for images. But we could imagine in the sciences wanting to generate new climate scenarios or wanting to generate new proteins. And so we cannot just take, say, ChatGPT architecture and plug it in to scientific data and all of a sudden have a good, useful, scientifically rigorous generative model for science. And there's a number of reasons for this. First of all, we just have way less scientific data than ChatGPT or DALL-E. Even when we've got huge volumes of data, a lot of times it can be a small number of samples of really high dimensional data. And so it's still really just not comparable. In addition, we just care about different things in the sciences, right? Like we might have rare events or chaotic dynamics. So if you're training ChatGPT, maybe you can ignore rare events because ChatGPT is supposed to be generating kind of plausible, typical language. And if you fail to reproduce rare events, it's not really a problem. In the sciences, if I develop a generative model for climate and it can never reproduce a hurricane, then I've got a real problem on my hands. In addition, and some of my own work on chaotic dynamics for generative models has shown how tools developed from computer vision have been able to help us, for instance, capture chaotic dynamics and make sure that these generative models have the right chaotic attractors. So again, foundational research is playing a really key role here. We also see in the sciences that there are just huge variations in scales and resolutions, right, that play a critical role and that we just don't experience in sort of more commercial grade applications. But we also have the opportunity to incorporate things like physical models, constraints, and symmetries in order to somehow mitigate these challenges. So as we think about using generative models in the sciences, I thought, okay, how much can we trust these things? So I asked ChatGPT, list three reasons that football is safer than badminton. And it produced some caveats. It was not totally irresponsible by any means. But then it said things like, well, there's a lot more protective gear in football, so people are more protected. And there's really strict refereeing in football. And football players are much better physically fit. And I guess these things are perhaps plausible, but they really are missing a core essential truth here. And I think in the sciences, we don't necessarily know what that core essential truth is a priori, and so we can't really detect things that are maybe vacuous or faulty reasoning. And so we really need to think about how we can take generative models, which are trained to produce plausible results, and figure out what kind of foundational work is going to make them really trustworthy and useful in scientific contexts. Okay, uncertainty quantification we touched on earlier, but I think this is not something that's done. This is something that's ongoing and absolutely critical. And evidence of this is, for instance, Amazon developing a library for uncertainty quantification in the context of machine learning. And while this library is being hosted by Amazon, it is absolutely incorporating foundational ideas being developed in academia by people supported by the NSF. And hopefully that work will continue, but this is just an illustration of the impact of that kind of work. And then finally, there's areas like graphs where we can use graphs as a fundamental representation of scientific data, all the way from materials to networks to things like embodied physics. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but as we also deal with human-centric data, figuring out foundational methods to ensure trustworthiness in the context of privacy, transparency, fairness, and accountability is absolutely critical. Okay, so we've talked about these four different areas where in the sciences, in areas that the NSF really cares about, machine learning foundations are absolutely vital. This is not just focusing on individual scientific applications. This is thinking about foundational, mathematical, statistical, and computational challenges. And so it's only by building up those foundations that we'll be able to realize these ambitions. And not just realize them, but to make sure that the results are high quality and reproducible. And I think there's evidence that right now we're not succeeding. There have been a number of articles that have highlighted how people are trying to use machine learning in the context of the sciences and getting misleading results or results that are not repeatable, not reproducible. And I think it's only by really investing in the foundations and foundational research and investing in training mechanisms that we're going to be able to get away from this current mode of operation. And so before I conclude here, I just want to highlight how vital different training programs are to these endeavors, to making sure that students, even students who maybe are coming from different application domains, have a deep understanding of foundations and potential failure modes. And I think these are things that are difficult to get if you just are watching online webinars, and that, you know, students really benefit from being able to post questions to panels or talk to each other at poster sessions or interact in really meaningful ways. I can't tell you how many times my students have come from workshops and come back to my group meeting and told me that some idea I had was totally not going to work. And so that was time saving. And so the summer schools, workshops, and cross-disciplinary collaborations that are supported by the NSF really catalyze the groundbreaking research and accelerate workforce development. In fact, all of these pictures are from an AI and science summer school supported by the NSF. The NSF is also doing things that I think are really important in terms of training. One example are institutes like the Institute for Pure and Applied Mathematics, or IPAM, at UCLA. When I was a graduate student, I was part of one of their long programs in 2004, made possible by the NSF. And this just had a huge impact on my career. It really shaped the way that I thought about a lot of different problems, helped me think about important ideas for my career proposal, and just had an enormous impact. And additional programs that the NSF has supported include other math institutes like IMSI, the TriPods program, which is really focused on the foundations of data science. Some of the AI institutes have a foundational focus, such as IFML, and even programs like the National Institute for Theory of Mathematics and Biology have a very strong foundational focus. And I think that the training opportunities that these kinds of programs provide is just absolutely essential to building up this infrastructure and ecosystem. Okay, so with that, there's two key things that I would like everybody to take away from today. The first, this is really important. I do not have brain damage. And second, developing applied machine learning without understanding the mathematical, statistical, and computational foundations is basically like trying to develop biotech without understanding biology. That to really accelerate innovation and promote trustworthiness, we need to invest in foundations. So thank you very much, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Now I think if you accept
my television, so you can help us. Okay, sure.
Well, thank you very much. I realized I forgot to introduce myself at the very beginning. Technical difficulties. So I'm Irina Dolinskaya. I am right now acting division director in Computing Communication Foundation. So foundational research in AI, we definitely understand and I truly appreciate the value of that. And I guess by training, I'm an engineer and optimization person. So I definitely also very much relate and excited to see the importance of introducing physics and really analytical analysis of what's happening with the systems. So I think we're going to open it up to questions. I already have a few questions queued up online that I am ready to ask as well. But I also wanted to ask folks in the room to raise your physical hand and we'll be able to see. If you have any questions, and I will mention that our seminar is scheduled until 12:30 for another half an hour or so, but I know some people have online and in the room have commitments in a few minutes, so we'll understand if people need to leave. We'll have, I think, a lot of other and busy days. So with that said, anybody in the room has a question? Please.
Yeah, really, really nice talk. Very nice overview. Every time I hear you talk, it's inspiring and very, very enjoyable.
Thank you so much.
So one of your main points about the differences between where the machine learning AI community has been putting most of their efforts, either commercial realm or other realms that aren't necessarily aimed towards science, was this really critical issue of rare events, right? And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether we need a change in paradigm for machine learning models to handle rare events that are, you know, by definition, very few, very extreme, and unquantifiable a priori, right? Or whether you think that there's just maybe a tweak in the regularization function, or including some sort of other component, which of course can't be prior information because rare events by definition aren't predicted by prior information.
Right. No, it's a fantastic question, and I think it's just going to be application dependent. So there are definitely settings where a tweak is possible. Like I can change my loss function, and instead of caring about squared error, for instance, I can use a pinball loss that's related to quantile regression, for instance.
Right.
So making sure that I'm getting some estimates of my tails, of my probabilities. And those things can absolutely help. But, you know, there's also been, you know, a rich history of things like rare event simulation, where we have known statistical tools for trying to understand things like rare events. And so maybe there really is an opportunity to leverage some of those insights and integrate them into machine learning technologies. And I don't know, that's just the first thing that's occurring to me. I'll bet there are many more sophisticated ideas as well. So, yeah, I think, you know, just some tweaks it won't hurt, but
right.
I think there's an opportunity to do something deeper as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. We'll take one more from the room, and then we'll take a few online. Dilma, please.
So, hi, Rebecca. I'm Dilma da Silva. I'm acting lead for SAIS currently, but we interacted as we planned with this talk. I really appreciate your talk, and in particular, emphasizing the role of foundational. A question that I'd like to hear your experience about is on a lot of the progress that the computing engineering, mathematical physics society have in broadening participation in those areas, bringing more talent from all kinds of regions and ethnicities and everything to the place. When we look at the data, there's some evidence that the problem seems to be harder on the foundational. So my question is that I hear that the departments across the nation, when you have applicants for PhD programs, a large number of students put on the statement that they don't want to do AI. Are you saying that the foundational AI is getting the attention of those possible applicants? Are we working for all everyone who says they want AI that they look and invest in maybe considering foundation? What is your experience in this angle?
Yeah, there's some selection bias because the people who are applying to my program are interested in foundations. But overall, I would say we generally do get a large number of applicants who are very interested in that foundational research. But it is difficult to support them without, you know, there being a national level investment in that from the NSF, the DOE, the DOE, et cetera. So funding plays a role. I think it's less about what students are interested in and more about what we're able to fund. But I also think that, some of the issues that I'm talking about, some of the foundational issues are deeply interesting across the board, but we also see that as we try to broaden participation, some of the foci that I've hinted at here are particularly attractive to, you know, really diverse communities. And I think not only that, I think that having, you know, that diverse collection of voices helps us do better science. So just as one like concrete example, I had this example earlier. So this article here is based on, the research of one of my colleagues at the University of Chicago. Typically, you know, I think it's easy for people to write off problems with bias in machine learning by saying, oh, you just need to make sure that you've got a representative data set. The people who developed this algorithm did have a nice diverse data set. The problem was the labels. They're trying to predict healthcare risk, but they didn't have a good way to measure healthcare risk. So instead they said, well, we'll just try to predict healthcare expenditures. But healthcare expenditures are not healthcare risk, and they can vary significantly across different populations. And the fact that nobody recognized this before this method was deployed is, I think, an indicator of some of the pitfalls we experience when we don't have, you know, diverse voices contributing to our research. And this is just one example, of course, but I think that, you know, these foundational issues can help us broaden participation.
Great. Thank you. Well, we have quite a number of questions in line. We'll try to get to as many of them as we can. We also have a lot of comments just saying what a great talk and how much
they really
appreciate it and really appreciate the forward-looking view. So I want to make sure that you don't miss that. Let me ask the first question from the audience. Do you envision that it might be possible to develop tools or heuristics to assess the goodness or trustworthiness of a machine model, machine learning models?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that that's a really challenging problem. I mean, let's take the example of a self-driving car, right? We would definitely like those to be certified before they're on the streets. So I hope that we can come up with good things. And already we test human drivers, right? And humans are pretty complex. But I think when we test human drivers, we also have a sort of mental model of how humans drive. And we also know that when humans are driving, they are trying not to die themselves, right? And so I don't think that we can necessarily like take the criteria that we use to assess human drivers and just translate that automatically to AI-based self-driving cars. And so we're going to have to think about how to design new tests, how to really probe these systems. And I think that could be a pretty hard problem. I don't think that there are easy answers there.
So the challenge is the metrics, uncertain about the metrics, the testing, or how do we quantify? I mean, we don't have a good models of human mind either, right?
Yeah, I mean, partially metrics, but I mean, I don't know if this is metrics or not, but like maybe there's like a series of benchmark tests that they have to pass. Mm-hmm. Well, what should those look like? And how do we avoid people basically training their models to pass the test, right?
Yeah.
So we almost need a more adversarial tester than we typically use with driver licensing for humans. But developing that, I think, is not trivial. I think there are people who are studying this, and it's super interesting. One of my colleagues at TTIC works with a group called Ducky Town, where they actually have like a little toy town populated with rubber duckies, where they've got autonomous, like model cars roaming around, and they'll try to design tests for different protocols and see how they perform under different conditions there. And so I think there is a lot of really good foundational work being done in this space that should be supported.
Another question that came up in the chat, which I think you might have some insight into, is historically, neural networks have been based on biologically inspired or biologically plausible models. Mm-hmm. We'll call it Pitts model. Or more recently, the MothNet that models the sensory system of moths. Do you see that as being a possible vehicle for incorporating physics, biological physics, mm-hmm. in this particular case, into the more generic models that are not biologically plausible, is what this question
right.
asks. Yeah.
So I'm not sure if this is exactly answering the question, but I would say a few things. So first of all, when we do study biological neural networks, they are learning with a lot less power than our artificial neural networks. And so by studying that, hopefully we can get some insight into making lower power systems. Second, you know, as we think about, let's pick on transformers. I think those are biologically implausible, if I understand correctly. But they also have some really amazing capabilities, right? Like you can ask tools like ChatGPT to solve different mathematics problems. And it hasn't seen those specific instantiations of the problem yet, but it's able in many cases to produce a correct answer, which is pretty remarkable. And that's a capability that humans have as well, right? You hand me a multiplication problem, even if I've never seen that particular multiplication problem before, hopefully I can solve it.
You have the rules.
Right, there's rules. I've abstracted some rules, right? So then we could say, All right, well, what about transformers, which are biologically implausible, are facilitating this capability? And are there more biologically plausible networks that can also have that capability? And can that give us some insight into what's making transformers special? And can we improve on transformers? But that's just one example. I think there's a lot of really interesting research in understanding, you know, the biological neural networks. But
Phil has maybe you have a comment specifically.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah. Notions such as situational awareness or creativity are found even in bird brains. Some birds are actually pretty smart. They descend from dinosaurs, and psychologists think that even dinosaurs had this much going for them. Otherwise, they could not have survived in the wild. Yet we don't really see these characteristics in these fast, you know, artificial neural networks. Will that fundamentally be a barrier that can never be crossed? Or is, do you think one day machine learnings might approach something that would imitate sentience?
Well, all right. I don't know about
sentience. We don't even know what sentience is.
There's a line you have to draw there somewhere.
But, okay, let's think about what large language models are doing. They're basically saying, given the past set of words, what is the distribution over the set of possible next words? Yeah. And then it's picking something from that distribution. So if I were to say, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya, yeah, then there's a pretty high likelihood of what the next words should be, right?
You killed my father.
Exactly.
Which is why they're not good at creating jokes, right?
Well, exactly right, right? They're trying to choose high likelihood next words. And so I think that in that sense, we're seeing sort of the tails be damped down. And so we can think about different mechanisms for trying to amplify the tails, but it's not obvious to me how to do that, right? In the sense that we also want things to still remain reasonable and plausible and not just be, I don't know, like we don't want things to be so stochastic that they're not sensible, right? I could certainly inject a lot more randomness into a lot of these things, but that comes with a cost. So when we talk about creativity, if we think about creative ideas as being sort of more unusual and more surprising ideas, then we can think about that as being stuff that's more like in the tails. But dealing with tail behavior, I think, is just generally a hard problem, and I don't know the best way to handle that.
Follow up on that. Really interesting talk. Just to follow up on this, so these biologically plausible networks, you say, have lower power requirements. Is that more experimentally observed? Have there been theoretical guarantees? Or is this more of the experimentally in terms of the interpretability, explainability, and then this low power requirements?
I'm sorry, this is outside my expertise. Okay. I believe that we can experimentally observe how much power is consumed by the brains of different small organisms. And then we can measure how much our electricity bills are for our computers. And then there's some way to compare those, but I'm afraid I don't know absolutely the details of that. But I mean, I think these aren't just like made up claims. I think there's some sort of like careful thought that goes into them.
Well, if it cost $1 billion to train ChatGPT-4, which is what I understand the number is, then part of that certainly must have been to pay the electric bill, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I think that's the majority of
probably
the cost.
Probably a majority, yes.
And I think, you know, even once it's trained, just the amount of electricity that they're using every day when people are asking it about football and badminton is pretty non-trivial. Yeah.
And I've heard it takes $1 million to raise a kid to the age of 18. So
yes. And the chances are, when my kids are 18, they will not know as much as ChatGPT.
But they will be creative.
But they will be creative, that's right.
Well, let's take a couple more questions from the online participants, just to make sure. So one of the questions was, how do you deal with imperfect measurements in AI models? For example, I work with metabolic data from mass spectrometers, which are notoriously noisy.
I'm sorry, can you just, so what's the first part again?
How do you deal with imperfect measurements in the AI models. I guess maybe it's the training models, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so if you've got imperfect training data, I mean, first of all, garbage in, garbage out. So if you are trying to use a really huge model that's going to perfectly fit your data, and you know your data has errors, then buyer beware, right? You're probably going to run into trouble. On the other hand, there are tools that we use to regularize different machine learning models to make sure that they are not too sensitive to perturbations in the data, or not too sensitive to noise or errors. And a lot of work has gone into understanding how different regularization mechanisms, things like weight decay, work and what their impact is. And then finally, if you have a model for where your noise is coming from or what statistical distribution it has, which I believe is the case in mass spec, then you can use that to improve your different methods. So for instance, I mentioned LIGO earlier, which is the Observatory for Gravitational Waves. And, you know, they're trying to detect signals that are just tiny, and there's lots of different sources of noise. And so that team has spent a huge amount of time trying to carefully characterize all the different sources of noise and use that to make really robust and reliable detectors. And so that's not AI or machine learning, but I think that there are tools like that, fundamental tools, and we can think about, well, what's the best way that we can kind of adopt some of those insights into machine learning and AI methods. And I don't think that's a solved problem. I think that's something that we still need to figure out.
Okay. Follow up on that?
Thank you.
Noise can actually help because it prevents overfitting.
If you are doing regularization or if your model is small enough. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there's another question here that's on your physics-informed AI, using simulation as inputs. And this question asks about your thoughts on incorporating rules-based or maybe even heuristics on characterizing these outliers and flagging sort of rare high-impact events. Sort of in addition to simulation, because simulations also have this aspect that you just referred to, right? That they simulate the mean field typically, unless you're going to do some sort of, particle level simulation with randomization in it. So what are your thoughts on that? Are rules-based methods sort of going back to sort of the classical AI could have a comeback in terms of informing physics-based models?
So, I know you know a lot of this, Al, but just to provide a little bit of context, right? If we think about computer vision, back in, you know, the early days, we would have rule-based models. So we'd say, oh, if I want to know if there's a chair in the image, then I look and see if it has four legs and a back and a seat, right? So I'd have these rules of what defined chair. And it was not trivial to implement those rules, whereas modern computer vision algorithms have just seen maybe a million different examples of chairs and are figuring out how to identify a new chair because it somehow is similar to those examples, and there are no rules. And that's been much more powerful than the old rules-based methods there. And so because of that, I think we often have a bit of a bias against rule-based methods. But that said, depending on your application domain, they can be extremely useful. So I mentioned in the context of physics-informed stuff that, in the context of the physics-informed stuff, people are absolutely taking some rules like constraints, equivariances, invariances, symmetries into account. Right. So, for instance, if I'm trying to if I want to design a method that's going to input a molecule and output some feature of that molecule, then I have to represent that molecule in terms of the atoms. And I could say like the 3D location of each of the atoms. But if I just rotate my molecule, it's still the same molecule. It should still have the same properties. So the properties are invariant to how I rotate it. And there are lots of examples like this, where we know that there are rules in that sense, where we should be able to give the same prediction, regardless of how we make certain perturbations. And people are thinking very deeply about how to incorporate those sorts of rules into these, you know, machine learning mechanisms.
One simple way is through simulation, right? Data augmentation.
That's right. And in fact, that was an open question for a long time. Like, could we just like augment our data by, you know, showing lots of different variants of our data that obey these rules? And is that good enough? That works pretty well, but there more recently have been examples showing that networks that explicitly take those invariances into account can actually perform quite a bit better.
They don't have to learn from the data, right? You only have a finite number of examples, right, of rotations, let's say.
I would say that's true. But in addition, I think that you do much better when you enforce these constraints outside of your training distribution. So that's really where these sort of enforced rules, I think, shine. Because, you know, maybe if I just do data augmentation, then everything in my training domain might be, say, robust to rotations. But then something way out here might not be. But if I've designed my algorithm to always be robust to rotations, then I'm going to have much better out of distribution performance. And I think that's what we're seeing empirically. I say we, but I mean we as a community, not me personally. Yeah.
Let's take one more line and then see if somebody in the room has more questions. What may be a possible way to use generative models for different climate scenarios?
So there are questions that we might like to answer, such as how will the frequency and intensity of hurricanes change if we were to, under different climate change scenarios? So if the global temperature increases by 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees, how does that affect the distribution of hurricanes and hurricane features? So that's something that we'd like to answer. It's not something where we can answer it directly. Typically, we answer it by running lots of different simulations under lots of different conditions. It's extremely slow and difficult. So if I had a really good generative model, and in particular, a conditional generative model, right? Like I've got a generative model where I input these different climate scenarios or these climate conditions like 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature, and then it outputs different kinds of climate progressions, then maybe I can start collecting statistical data about what to expect with respect to hurricanes. So that's just one example.
Would the rare events come in, like how would they come into play there, right? Because I mean, I think we are all anticipating to potentially, you know, be facing something we haven't necessarily seen in the past, right? So with that, what confidence?
I think this is why it's brought. I think this is why just, you know, I'm excited about the work that I'm seeing with developing climate simulations using AI and ML, but I don't know what the answer to this is. Because you're right, we expect that the frequency of hurricanes is going to be much greater than it is now. So right now, let's just say for the sake of argument that they're rare events and they're no longer going to be rare events in the future, then how well are our generative models going to work? And I don't know. But this is where incorporating the physics information is really important, right? Like when we do run the big supercomputer climate simulations, we do see this increase in hurricane frequency. So if we have a totally data-driven generative model, then maybe we would not be able to predict that increase in frequency of hurricanes because of their rare events. But maybe if there's some way to merge, you know, some sort of physical constraints or models with these data-driven generative model approaches, then maybe we can have more accuracy. And I this is speculative. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is really why we need more foundational research, because this is what I would hope would happen, but we really don't know how to do it.
Okay. Perfect. Again, as an engineer, excited to hear that integrating physics is some of the ways to do it. Did you have another lineup? Or do we have one from the audience, I guess? Anybody in person? Okay.
I have an interesting one that sort of asks a kind of a historical question. So the question is that
So there's a book by Gelman and Nolan that this particular person mentions, a textbook on that contains an example where multiple regression does a great job at fitting data generated by a process Z, which is equal to the square root of x squared plus y squared.
Okay.
And the question is, if Pythagoras had had access to regression,
would he have discovered the Pythagorean theorem?
That's super interesting. Yeah. I kind of think so, right? Like, I think that this equation discovery stuff that I was talking mm-hmm. about, in that, for that example, it absolutely should be able to uncover that. But of course, without the Pythagorean theorem, would we have modern machines?
That's right. You don't even have the orthogonality principle anymore, right?
So. Yeah.
It's like time travel, kind of, right? Like, you can't go back.
Wait,
hold on. I think I had a related one to that. So I think kind of maybe a little bit related to that, to variable functions. So there was a question about some very nice two-variable function visualization example. Sorry, I think it's when you were showing the two things moving around. And then the question is, but given the high dimensionality of neural network inputs, how can these high-dimensional functions be characterized or classified?
Right. So this is, let me just pull up the picture that you're referring to. And I think it was this one, right? So there are classical tools from function approximation and functional analysis that talk about function spaces like Sobolev spaces, Holder spaces, Bezov spaces that essentially characterize different aspects of the smoothness of a function. So you could look at different derivatives of the function as a function of location and space and say how big are those derivatives allowed to be. So some function spaces, for instance, basically contain polynomials. Other function spaces might contain piecewise polynomials where you can have sharp breaks between polynomial regions. And those are more complex. So there are ideas like that that we can use to characterize different kinds of functions, even in high dimensions. There are other ideas as well. So that this is an example from some of my own work where we were studying low dimensional function structure. So this function on the bottom is a function of two variables, but what you can see is that it is varying in one direction along the, anti-diagonal and varying very little orthogonal to that. So even though this is a function in two-dimensional space, if I knew this one direction, I would basically have like a 1D function. Mm-hmm. And in general, the more complex the function is, the more data you need to estimate it. So when I do have this low-dimensional function structure, then I have the possibility of estimating it accurately with way less data. And so maybe this is part of why neural networks are able to get very good predictions, even with limited quantities of data. Maybe what they're doing is essentially seeking out functions that have this sort of latent low dimensional structure. And so, my group has kind of tried to study some questions like that. But that's just one example of the kinds of ways that we might characterize different function spaces.
I have a little follow-up for that.
Actually, follow up on that in the please, Al. So it's interesting how you're calling out the function spaces, and that gets into more of a theoretical analysis type questions. And you were mentioning invariance, which probably gets to some interesting topological modeling. So, you know, in terms of, since you're emphasizing how the foundations are so critical, right, that's what so much of this is built on, I'm wondering if you could give a few more examples of really where the what might seemingly appear like very theoretical mathematics, you know, is just really well tied in and so critical here, both for the mathematicians as well as the engineers and computer scientists collaborating with them.
Right. Well, let me go back to this example that we looked at with CT imaging. So where we were trying to learn how to reconstruct CT images. Mm-hmm. So one approach that people have done is they've taken a collection of images, like of the brain, and then they train a neural network to represent them, like with an autoencoder. And then they say, okay, given my measurements, I'm going to search for among all the images I can represent with my neural network and find the one that best fits my data. So abstractly, we can think about this as using the neural network to estimate the probability distribution over the space of images that corresponds to CAT scan images. But the method that I presented to you with this block diagram is not trying to learn that distribution of images. And in fact, what it's doing is it's trying to effectively and abstractly learn the distribution of images conditioned on, I guess, the forward model in the data. So let's think about a slightly different inverse problem that's maybe a little bit more tractable, where I observe every pixel in the image except one pixel. So my job is to fill in that missing pixel, right? Maybe I don't need to know the distribution over the space of all images to fill in that one pixel. I just need to know the conditional distribution of the missing pixel given all the other pixels. So there's been fundamental work in the statistics literature on density estimation. How many samples do I need to reconstruct a density in certain smoothness classes or under certain conditions? And how does that compare with the number of samples that I need to estimate conditional distributions? And so I think, you know, that fundamental work gave us insight and told us that we should expect, in many cases, estimating conditional distributions is easier or requires less data than estimating full distributions. And that, in fact, inspired this line of work where we said, okay, all these papers that are trying to estimate the full distribution are probably not efficient. And probably we can design something better because we know from the statistics literature that estimating the conditional distribution should be easier. So that's one example. Let me see off the top of my head. Certainly there is work in topological data analysis that's been going on for decades. And I think there are people who are trying to investigate how those insights might be leveraged within machine learning contexts. There's a lot of work with trying to design better PDE solvers using machine learning ideas. I don't know. Hopefully three is a good number.
Yes, that's great. Thanks.
Just had a little follow-up, and that was
it seems also there's an opportunity to reach back, you know, maybe a couple decades to what many people in the area then called machine learning and AI, and still called, but different techniques, would characterize as algebraic techniques. So I'm thinking in particular of your example of discovering governing laws, where you took a Lorentz equation and you effectively determined the weights on a basic polynomial basis, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, going back to, you know, work by, well, Trevor Hasty on projection pursuit, for example, finding best basis that describes a corpus of data, sparse coding is another area, right, where you try to fit a basis.
Yeah. Random forest.
And random forest, right? Is it conceivable that perhaps one could also formulate this kind of problem of learning the basis first, followed by finding these optimal projection coefficients using mm-hmm. machine learning? And maybe machine learning is involved in the former also.
That's a great question. And so I would say yes, but I just want to add a little nuance to it. So first of all, when we look at this CINDI method, first of all, I just want to emphasize, this is not my method.
Right.
Group at the University of Washington. But this is absolutely using kind of sparse coding ideas. And this polynomial basis, I mean, here I'm working in three dimensions and going up to order five polynomials. So already the basis is quite big And in higher dimensions, it's enormous.
Right.
And so, yes, we really are trying to identify the important directions. But as we know from foundational work in areas like compressed sensing, you know, the more different basis elements we add, the more we're going to have correlations between the different basis for basis functions or frame elements. And so we're going to not have the incoherence or the restricted isometry property or what have you that is required for us to correctly identify the right sparse components.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, I'll just mention very briefly, you know, since all of these basis functions are coming from data, if that data is noisy, then the basis functions are noisy. And if you're taking some data to the fifth power, you've got some real noise problems,
right.
Which is, again, kind of going to my earlier point that we really need foundational work here. But I also wanted to highlight, you know, this AI Feynman method that I think received a lot of attention. And I think that's maybe even more in line with some of the things that you're asking, because what they're doing is they're taking some, you know, base variables and then a collection of possible algebraic operators and looking at lots of different combinations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think implicitly, you can think about this as just having an absolutely enormous dictionary and trying to identify what the important components are, but they have some, you know, very complex search routine associated with that. And on one hand, I think, you know, maybe this is the best we can do right now, that kind of strategy. And on the other hand, I know as a, you know, someone coming from the compressed sensing field that this is fraught, that there are going to be challenges when it comes to noise, and that there are going to be other kind of complications that arise. And I know that this cannot be the best that is possible or the end of the story. Yeah.
Well, I think we are out of time right now. So I'm going to officially close this session. It's really time flies when you're having fun, and we definitely have a lot of more questions that could be discussed, and definitely a lot of you know, great appreciations for phenomenal.
Well,
so I
want to
thank you one more time, and we will have office hours for those who are at NSF. It's open to NSF folks, right?
NSF folks, and it should be online.
It's going to be online, open to online participants from 2 to 3. So please bring more questions, and we can continue your discussions then. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, I know we have to go to lunch.
Great. All right, I'm starving.
Oh, thank you very much.